Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Gabriel Doherty, UCC historian, thank you for joining me again on this Cork History Matters podcast. We're on episode 3 of our look at the events of 1920, an astounding year in the history of Cork. If we might review somewhat, and if I could connect it to where we are right now in terms of pandemic, because you know, end of 1919 was roughly the second wave of Spanish flu, as it was then.
Roughly speaking. And, of course, remember, it wasn't simply the Spanish flu. There were other forms of disease which were circulating at the time. In fact, there is a record of an outbreak of, believe it or not, a bubonic plague.
Wow.
A single reference to an incidence of bubonic plague in Dublin at the time. So infectious diseases were, not surprisingly, in the aftermath of a
TB,
war.
The Irish.
Tuberculosis, of course, also rampant. So from a simple public health point of view, and of course, with all the dislocations in terms of what was happening in Cork in 1920, the provision of public health services, which were never particularly satisfactory, were detrimentally impacted.
But the waves decreased in their intensity in the Spanish flu, much as they appear to be doing with coronavirus.
Well, we won't speak too soon about that. Yes.
So you know, over the course of 1920, Spanish flu is receding as a thing, as a real impact on people's lives.
It is, but again, I'd stress the point that in terms of the number of people just dying, as it were, from ordinary causes such as infectious diseases, we're at a far higher level than they are today in terms of life expectancy, even in the space of that 100 years. I mean, you're talking about 12 to 13 years, the average life expectancy now. It's gone up, I think, into the 80s, where it was the late 60s. And it, depending on which particular part of the city, if you're in a city, Cork, your life expectancy would be lower again than that. So.
Okay, but just for the context of the times, they were going through a pandemic. You know, all the time that we've read that history in school or heard it or documentaries, whatever, I don't know if any of us actually, first of all, would have been able to relate to what it meant to be in a pandemic as we can now. But it's just
interesting. That goes for historians too.
Yes, yes. And it's just interesting now to consider that as a factor and an element. You know, I'm tempted to get diverted down into that, like where churches closed and where people gathering and when did it, how did it all go? But look, that's another thing. I just want to briefly review, because the main subject or the main topics for us to tackle here, certainly we'll touch on Bloody Sunday, how can you not? Because we finished in episode 2 at the funeral of Terence McSweeney and all of that story, and we left the cliffhanger there, and here we pick it up, and it'll be a look at Bloody Sunday, although of course that's not a Cork affair, but it's such a huge event, and we've just passed the commemoration of that, the 100 year anniversary, and we approach the 100 year anniversary of Kilmichael, which is a huge event as well, and then we lead up to the burning, and it almost sees us out for 1920. What a year in Irish history, certainly what a year for Cork history, and that's why we're focused on it. But a brief review, you know, we went through Solo Head Beg was in 1919, but 1920 is the year where the War of Independence really takes off. It's very much centred in Southern Ireland, and we've a whole range of events that we talked about, you know, barracks in Middleton and the like being taken over by the IRA, pushing the RIC back into the city. We've the assassination of Lord Mayor Tomás McCurtain in his home in Blackpool in roughly March type time. A shocking event. Black and Tans arrive around that time. The auxiliaries not long after them. It all escalates from there. Like, to see the photos of the city with the barbed wire around the courthouse and Washington Street and Cork City Hall, a frequent target. Shots fired at the clock regularly. It's just insane to think of the city being
and
like
and
that.
And the curfew. Remember, this is something which is an ever-present reality from July onwards. The British, in the aftermath of the shooting of the RIC District Inspector Smith in the Country Club on the South Mall, the British impose a curfew from 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. So if you were abroad during those hours, for whatever reason, if you didn't stop on request and identify yourself, you could be shot out of hand. And there were a number of people who, for whatever reason, found themselves abroad pot shots were taken at them, and they did have a couple of fatalities. So anybody, let's say a doctor or a midwife who was called out to deal with the medical emergency,
were taking their life in their hands.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
The medical insignia or a white flag or something didn't
well,
count.
I mean that's what they would have to do, and they would have to even then proceed very, very cautiously,
gingerly through the streets.
Absolutely.
McSweeney takes over from McCurtain following his death. We went through his story, the long hunger strike, the world impact that had, the way the British had learned their lessons after the funeral of McCurtain and decided that, well, they really played games with the funeral of McSweeney. He was supposed to be shipped back to Dublin, only over the docks in Bristol, perhaps it was.
Holyhead,
where they told that, no, you're going, left on the quayside in Cove. It's incredible stuff.
Yeah.
So the city celebrated the McSweeney funeral or stood out for him, but in a different way, not quite as, say,
there was a massive turnout for the McSweeney funeral. The restrictions that the army imposed was on the cortege, specifically the number of people who could follow in the cortege, and the insistence that there could be no military formations, so you couldn't have the large numbers of volunteers turning out in uniform and marching behind the cortege. But it's in terms of simple number of individuals who were crowding the streets, in terms of the floral displays that were sent, in terms of the numbers of messages of condolences. As you say, it's a global event. I mean, I've looked at some of these messages, and it takes a long time to work through them because there are so many of them. But they're coming from Norway, they're coming from South Africa, they're coming from Latin America,
Catalonia.
It's really striking. This puts Cork absolutely in terms of public attention, not just in Ireland, not just in the United Kingdom, but in Europe and globally, as the very centre point of news coverage of what's happening in Ireland.
And let me ask you for the famous McSweeney quote. I presume it's right to be attributed to him, and I may not get it right, so please help me with this, if you would, Gabriel. It's not how much you can suffer,
it's not those who can inflict the most. Form in which it's rendered in the printed version of his speech, because it was the speech he delivered at his inauguration as Lord Mayor.
Right, okay.
It's not necessarily the same as it's popularly remembered, but it's generally remembered. It's not those who can inflict the most, but those who can endure the most who will win out. And of course, certainly Cork was enduring a huge amount at that point.
The Forgotten Lord Mayor is the recently released book by A. Quinlevin.
Yeah.
Talks of O'Callaghan is now Lord Mayor, the third Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of the city in 1 year. Mm. So where are we at following McSweeney's funeral? 1st of November?
1st of November is the funeral. That also happens to be the day on which Kevin Barry is executed in Dublin. Of course, this introduces an even more sinister aspect to the proceedings, because it's now a case that the British, if you're captured in arms, not even necessarily in the way that Kevin Barry was conducting an ambush, but if you had a weapon on your person or ammunition, then you could be executed, and a number were. And of course, a legal question is whether this constituted a simple war crime. Execution of prisoners by any standard of military law is a war crime. The IRA,
even though we weren't under military law at that point, so it would have been civil law.
But
so
it's interesting that the British themselves went to court subsequently to get a declaration from their own courts that a state of war existed, because that would have retrospectively enabled them to take legally the steps that they took. So the British wanted it both ways. They wanted, legally speaking, to have a state of war exist, which would now enable them to do certain things. But they wanted to deny the IRA belligerent rights and the right to be recognised as an army, an organised army, an organised military force, and that would protect them in terms of execution.
Kevin Barry, famously a young medical student at UCD and made famous by ballad and song and commemorated in that fashion. And yet the event in which he was captured at saw the well, I suppose, you know, do you call it the murder of a 16-year-old Irishman who was an RIC member?
In a sense, it's an act of war. I come back to the point that, as far as the British were concerned, their acts were justified because a state of war existed, and they sought a court order to direct that was so. But they refused to recognise that the IRA could conduct themselves. But certainly, I mean, you did have...
So in other words, they were justified, but the IRA weren't.
Exactly.
It's just funny, you know, because, you know, people will have sung that ballad and, you know, he's a hero in the foundation myth of the state, no question.
Yep.
And yet the event he was involved in saw the The killing, I mean, it's perhaps not fair to say cold blood, but certainly the killing
of an ambush. I mean,
of a boy, yeah. Of a boy in uniform.
Yes.
And who's not remembered.
No, he's not remembered. And I suppose on the British side, there were acts of remembrance at the time. Mm. Certainly, if anybody who, any British soldier who's taken back.
It's all a murky story, I suppose.
It is. Inevitably, I suppose, to the extent to which the Irish state is the successor and the inheritor of the Republican campaign, inevitably there has been a focus on those who fought on the Republican side. But I think, as a historian, I think it is becoming this, or everybody should be remembered. I mean, at the end of the day, sort of, if you believe in the principle of equality as a Republican principle, then you have to accept that in death everybody is equal.
And does that tie in with the controversy that we had last year, where there was talk of let's commemorate through these years as well those who died, the Irishmen who died serving the Royal Irish Constabulary at the time? Because that did cause a kerfuffle, didn't it?
I think, well, earlier this year, I think the controversy there isn't so much those sort of remembering simple people who fall. I think the bigger controversy was there was, as we were honouring the institution itself, and celebrating the institution and giving it full state recognition. Mm. Something, for example, when the Irish Volunteers, the centenary of the formation of the Irish Volunteers back in 2013, was not marked by a full state ceremonial event. So it seemed to be placing the RIC on a higher plane, as an institution, in terms of individual casualties, but as an organisation, on a higher plane.
There's part of you can almost see why a government would want to do that. The official body, as opposed to a collective that sprang to create an action of their own outside of the state.
Well, I suppose, one of the themes of the decade of centenaries has been as a conscious attempt to reconcile and the theme of reconciliation. Mm. But of course, that has to cut both ways. Mm. I mean, I don't think anybody is going to expect the British government to start commemorating the IRA of the War of Independence.
Well, despite Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge's best attempts. First of November, McSweeney's funeral, Kevin Barry executed on that day.
Yes.
We lead up to the 20th of November for Bloody Sunday and that really escalates everything. What happens in the intervening period?
What happens in the intervening is it just a constant pattern of ambushing, sniping, reprisals.
And it's mainly in the South, is it? Because there was a sense around Bloody Sunday that the war had come to Dublin.
Well, I mean, it's happening in Dublin as well. Okay. I mean, for example, the ambush in which Kevin Barry was arrested, which has happened weeks before, of course, remember, was part of a broader pattern, which is not surprising.
And that was a Dublin incident.
It was a Dublin incident, and it's not surprising because that's where the Royal Irish Constabulary had their headquarters, the Dublin Metropolitan Police had their headquarters, the British Army, even though their headquarters technically would be the Curragh, but had a huge establishment in Dublin. So there were plenty of targets for the IRA. But in terms of the general campaign, particularly in rural areas, there wasn't as much in rural parts of Leinster, for example, as there was in rural parts of Cork, Tipperary, Limerick, let's say. So certainly the Munster focus was very, very strong. Mm. So during those weeks between the funeral of McSweeney and Bloody Sunday, you just had this constant undercurrent. There are relatively few incidents which stand out as being sensational. But I would qualify that statement by saying in any other year, many of these incidents would have stood out as sensational. If you have military forces engaging each other in firefights, if that had happened in 1912 or 1906 or whenever, it would have been regarded as not a sensation. So it's a measure of just how far things had changed in Ireland and in Cork during 1920, that what would 10 years ago have been a sensation was regarded almost as the norm in those early weeks of November. One point I certainly would make, and this is where thinking forward towards the burning of Cork, is that reprisals were now in effect part of standard policy. The official reprisals policy, where you did actually have an imprimatur from the British government directing troops to carry out reprisals, happens after Christmas. But so frequent were these reprisals occurring with utter impunity that even before then, it was pretty clear that the government, at the very worst, was turning a blind eye to what was going on. And that was, of course, encouraging. So throughout these early weeks, you have a whole series of attacks going on, or engagements between the IRA and the British. And even where the British didn't lose any men, for example, in some of these engagements, they would burn down the local creamery, or they would burn down the houses of known IRA or Sinn Féin members or sympathisers in the locality. And if they couldn't find either, they would simply burn something. And that occurred in rural areas as well as in the city. As you mentioned there, the clock on the old city hall, I mean, it was simple recreational shooting for the fire of the British. They would simply point their weapons and start shooting. So the sound of gunfire wasn't just something that was that happened during a nighttime during ambushes. It was part of the everyday all or surround sound, as it were.
And do you have any sense of the physical change to the city and how incremental it was, whereby you've barbed wire and sniper posts?
And you have checkpoints being set up at random. Bridges are being monitored so that the British are making sure that anybody who's coming in, for example, from the south side of the city or from the north side, bridges were especially important. There are, to the extent to which vehicles were allowed, the British had already put severe restrictions on who could own or use a vehicle. They'd impounded any number of vehicles earlier in the year. So any vehicle that passed the British was stopping and checking them. And that didn't have to be just motorised vehicles, even just hand carts, the British were inspecting them. The British were carrying out daily raids, hundreds of raids over the course of these weeks on houses, particularly in, again, of known sympathisers. But at times just simply speculative to try and hope that they might find some intelligence or members of the Republicans operating in, as were, hitherto unknown safe house.
So the city looks almost like a war zone. City Hall, which is, you know, regarded as a hotbed of, which it is, a hotbed of republicanism and independence, is virtually barricaded up for fear of, for the amount of times that black and tans and auxiliaries are attempted to set it alight.
There had been attempts to, as you just mentioned, there had been attempts to set it alight before the successful one in the burning of Cork. In fact, there was a permanent representative from the fire brigade stationed in
Sullivan's Key, where the old tax office is roughly where the fire station was at that time.
Because it was expected almost on a daily basis that there were going to be these attacks. As you say, it's the outstanding Republican stronghold from a political point of view. The council,
it's the administrative centre of the city. It's incredible.
And like the council continues to meet during this time, to conduct its affairs, because, of course, the British
and they're taking their instruction from the Dáil.
Yes, absolutely. They pledged their allegiance to the Dáil back in January at the time of the same meeting.
And are the Dáil meeting surreptitiously and under...
Very, very rarely. I think there's about three meetings, I think, in the whole of 1920. Because, remember, a large number of them are over in America, including De Valera. Many of them, a large number of every month or so, are being arrested or interned. And those that are still on the run, it was incredibly dangerous to gather them all in the one place in case you did have an intelligence leak, and the British were able to take out the whole leadership cadre in one fell swoop.
And one of them is Michael Collins.
Is he
a member of Dáil Éireann?
Yes,
elected.
Absolutely. Yes.
Presumably in Cork, no? Or do we know?
Yes, it was. What was it? It wasn't. Was it? I think it was Wexford. I'd have to check the constituency. Yes, but he's a representative of Cork. He spends practically all of his time in Dublin.
Yes.
At this time, but he is a representative.
People describe Collins as having run the War of Independence, and then there's others who say, well, no one ran the War of Independence. It had a lot of independent areas and factions, but he certainly ran the intelligence.
I mean, he ran the Dublin end of the intelligence operation. And of course, that's where, again, you have special branch for RAC are stationed, the special branch for the Dublin Metropolitan Police, British military intelligence are stationed there. So that's, you get a lot of high quality material from there. But there was a separate intelligence operation here in Cork, Flory O'Donoghue.
So then you're agreeing with me in this sense that Michael Collins like ran everything. Well, he ran a very important operation, particularly when we look at the impact of Bloody Sunday and what it said and meant.
Yeah. But I mean, no one could do everything that Collins was supposed to have done. it was a very fair point, is that it suited both the Republicans and the British to, as it were, create this Superman image. The British, because it helped to explain their apparent failings, because they're up against this one superhuman individual. And the Republicans, of course, it helps to inspire them that they have this fantastic figure at their head.
And there's one thing that's amazing about it, which this isn't the right time to put it in, but I'll flag it and we'll return to it, is you know, in De Valera picking Collins for the treaty negotiations, it just never occurred to me that all of a sudden the guy they were looking for and the guy that's responsible in their eyes for all of these things is now sitting across the table. So Collins prepared a response for the events of Bloody Sunday and the why. And I don't know, did he ever deliver it to anyone? And it's a very powerful response. I don't know.
Yep. Well, I mean,
I think that's probably something.
Well, the events of Bloody Sunday, of course, are started by Collins.
So he gets his squad. They're up and running.
Well, and I suppose remember that there's these different terms. You have the squad, which are in effect the Praetorian Guard. These are the individuals who are carrying out the orders. You also have an active service unit of the Dublin Brigade, which technically is a separate unit. This is attached to the Dublin Brigade, but of course, because Collins is located in Dublin, all these individuals know each other. And then you have members of the regular Dublin Brigade of the IRA. So those who are involved on Bloody Sunday, it's these three separate
units. Were some people drafted from around the country to help?
There are many people in Dublin. For example, I mean, many of those who found life a bit too hot in their own localities, where of course they were known, could be identified on site, had moved to Dublin where it was easier for them to remain hidden.
So the squad that Collins and they weren't formed around Bloody Sunday. They existed anyway.
They existed, yes.
They draw up a plan to try to take down the G division or the.
No, these are
the British intelligence.
Yes, I mean these would be military intelligence officers. G division was the branch of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, which was the unarmed police force in Dublin, but their political section was the one which was the greatest threat to the Republicans because the headquarters of Sinn Féin and
is that Ned Brawley, who worked in Dublin Castle and allowed Collins access to the files for 5 hours and he read all the reports
and there are a number of other figures
that's who the G division are.
He's one of the members of G division, and Collins is able to get access to, and remember the files that he accessed weren't just solely those of G Division, it's some of the, as it were, the regular files as well. But I mean, and this had happened some months before, and this was one of the reasons why he assembles the squad in the first place.
Yes.
Because he
knows they have details on everyone.
We
need that.
Yes.
We need to know as much about them as they know about us. That was including
Collins himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, Collins himself had a file. He'd gone to ground during 1918, and there's very few additions after that. Even physically identifying him, although there were photographs. I mean,
but there are all those stories.
Yes, of course.
Whether they're apocryphal of him cycling up on a bike. Who are you looking for?
Well, I mean, that was true. I mean, it's talk about hiding in plain sight.
Yes.
I mean, he was impeccably dressed. He was the absolute antithesis of what an IRA gunman was believed to look like. The phrase was he looked like a stockbroker. He would deliberately go out of his way to engage with policemen and with soldiers as a way of trying to gain their confidence. Mm. And there were a number of escapades where, as much by good luck or bravado as good judgment, he was able to escape with the skin of his teeth. There was one incident where there was a reception for a visiting American delegation in 1919, a few months before. The military raided the Mansion House in Dublin, looking for Collins especially, but anyone else they could find. Collins managed to hide in the rafters, almost sort of spread-eagled for several hours. And then when the military left, he comes downstairs, and they still had pickets, as it were, on all the entrances. He comes down, gets dressed up impeccably and appears. And this Scarlet Pimpernel reputation he acquired, this was one of the beginnings of it.
He obviously had a bit of bravado. It's again not something for now, but I remember when I learned about the amphibious invasion of Cork by the Free State Forces to drive out the IRA, who had held it, this is during Civil War times, who held it for 6 months, drove them into their stronghold of West Cork. And what I didn't realise, it was just after that that Collins took his tour of West Cork, where he got
within days.
Why would you do that? Like, that's my question is, had he a streak of hubris about him?
It's a good question. I mean, it had worked for him up to that point. On the basis that...
A bit foolhardy.
You could argue if you ain't broke, don't fix it. Yeah. I mean, if the method seemed to have succeeded, then...
I probably shouldn't have introduced that much later point here. Yeah. So he knows he needs his intelligence to be as on point as the British.
Yes.
And he decides he needs to... Like, do we know when planning for Bloody Sunday began? Or
It had certainly been undertaken over a number of weeks. I mean, the British had upped their intelligence game earlier in the year. They had reorganised the intelligence section of both the Dublin Metropolitan Police. And remember that the G Division had been, about half of them had been wiped out. It wasn't a particularly big unit. There was only maybe, I think, 8 or 9 detectives involved. So I think 2 or 3 of them had been shot. Another one had been injured. And the remainder had, in effect, taken the cue that perhaps it was in their interest not to be too industrious in carrying out their duties. Mm. So the RAC had its... intelligence built it up, but it was the military that really upped the game, partly because they didn't necessarily trust the local police forces, because they believed that some of the Collins, and they were correct to do so, Collins was actually getting some information through the police.
So is part of this that Collins realises that due to their success in taking out some of the G Division members, that the military are now bringing their own intelligence guys in, and the game is going up, and I'm going to hit first.
Yeah. And these individuals have no ties to the country, or if they do, if they have any Irish ties, I mean, they're clearly loyalists and unionists. They're trained army officers. They're trained leaders. They're trained experienced killers because they've been involved in the war. They were men who would not hesitate to shoot first if needs be, and therefore, if you were and you had to take them all out at once. I mean, if you took one out on one day, that would alert everybody to the fact that they were vulnerable, and they would all simply retreat into Dublin Castle.
Such an audacious plan.
It is. I mean, it was. I mean,
and yet civilians killed in it. Some of the, again, the movie Michael Collins probably gives us a sense of a real, like...
Almost a Godfather type.
And yet, you know, some of the crews that were sent out didn't know what they were going to do, were nervous. Their hands were shaking so much, they were firing indiscriminately.
Yes.
They got the wrong people.
Yes.
A number of the houses, the people weren't there.
Yes.
You know, so it's far less...
No, it wasn't.
It's far less glorious, for want of a better word.
It wasn't as clinical as Collins would have wished.
Mm.
Certainly, I mean, there was no benefit in killing anybody who wasn't on the list, and clearly there were.
There was a Fitzgerald killed instead of a Fitzpatrick.
Yes, but I suppose one would point out that intelligence in any war is never 100%. I mean, unless you absolutely have sort of listening devices turned on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the headquarters of your opponent, you're only ever going to be operating off scraps of information. And Collins' genius was to bring all of these small pieces of, in some cases, low-grade intelligence and build a much bigger picture out of them. So, yes, I mean, it certainly wasn't as clean-cut, but what it was a clear indication to the British that Collins knew what they were up to.
Oh, the impact must have been
absolutely
huge. But it's just, I suppose, you know, when we look at it again as one of the founding myths of the nation, it was muddier and murkier and grubbier and grimier and you know, the closer you look at it, the more you're like, what? And the men that did it suffered.
Well, so, I mean, some of them, I mean, psychologically, in any war, especially for those who...
It might not have been that one incident, it might have been the accumulation.
Exactly. And anybody who's, it was their first time seeing somebody shot or even hearing a weapon. I mean, when weapons are discharged inside in a house, it is deafening.
In front of people shot in front of their wife and their kids.
Yes,
one of the men shot said, not in front of, you know, and asked to be... Horrific.
Yes, horrific. Absolutely.
And previously, you know, the IRA would have killed people probably on operations. Would there have been, like, assassinations of walking up to people in the street
there
and shooting from the behind
there
and the
had
like?
Been,
so this wasn't a completely new chapter.
Part of the problem was to actually go to where somebody was living was more dangerous.
Yes.
Simply because they would have their weapons there, and there are situations where, on Bloody Sunday, where some of those involved were reaching for their weapons. You had, in some cases, multiple members of the military forces in the one house, which was, of course, very, very dangerous.
But also some of the men wouldn't have, you know, would have had moral quandaries
of
about
course,
this
yes.
manner of
yes,
of
absolutely.
Warfare.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, to shoot somebody, as it were, with a rifle at hundreds of yards distance is one thing. Or as would happen in the First World War, bayonet fighting where it's hand-to-hand, but as it were, both sides are equally engaged. But to kill somebody who is unarmed, even if they're a military figure, and you know that they would not hesitate to shoot you if the roles were reversed. Still, is psychologically, of course, it's going to be very, very difficult.
So, is there 30 killed over the course of Bloody Sunday, or 32?
Well, 30 in Dublin. There were others who were killed in separate operations and other incidents around the country.
But the morning assassinations, it's something like 12. Is that a 14?
I think it's 14. I'd have to just check the figures Then, of course, you have the killings in Croke Park.
Well, here we go. So the British, you know, they assemble in Dublin Castle. Probably all sorts are drawn in from wherever they... In fact, that is, they wives and children and families pour into Dublin Castle for residence.
Precisely because they believe this is... They're either there or in military barracks. They can be sure that they're safe.
Because no one knows, is this the beginning of further bloodshed
over the course of the day or more generally?
And there's going to be a response.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, those who've been looking at the excellent coverage of the events which took place over the weekend will know that there was a great deal of uncertainty and fear in the air. Many people stayed off the streets. Because they feared what the reprisal would be. The fact that there would be a reprisal, I think nobody was in any doubt. What form it would take, whether it would simply be burning, whether it would be a roundup of Republican suspects. I don't think anybody was expecting a massacre of civilians. I mean, that really took, I think, many people by surprise, including those on the Republican side. Some of those, of course, who had been involved in the morning were at the match. The British came up with the idea that those that who'd taken part would hide in the crowd. They were there not to hide. I mean, it was probably the worst place you could hide because the match was, of course, in aid of Republican Dependence Fund. So it was a fundraiser for Republicans. So it was certain it was going to be a focal point of attention. But the vast majority of those involved in the morning don't go to the match. But
the GAA hadn't been particularly political up to that point.
Well, no, I mean, there had been a number of these fixtures going back a number of years, going back to 1917. And here in Cork, I mean, you had some people like Porrico Keefe, Nemo Rangers, after whom Porky Queeve is named, was arrested. You had people like Michael Fitzgerald, the hunger striker who died, was from Fermoy. He'd been a member of Fermoy GAA Club. Joseph Murphy had been a member of the bars.
Individual members.
Yes, yeah.
And obviously the organisation is hosting the game, which is a fundraiser.
And the GAA in Cork had, the army had occupied the athletic grounds, which is where the games were held in those days, on at least two or three occasions to prevent the GAA holding matches. So the GAA was certainly regarded by the British as being on the other side. But even then, it became a huge shock that civilians would simply be singled out for, in effect, execution.
Indiscriminate shooting into the crowd over 90 seconds. Like, in a way, it's almost a miracle less. More weren't killed.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There had been
a lot were injured now. In
a lot were injured. And remember, some of those who died weren't shot. Some of those were crushed underfoot.
And a boy, a young two lads outside the ground. One in a tree. One sitting on a wall. Yeah. One shot in the face. Yeah. It's mad. Yeah. Mad.
I mean, there had been a very famous or notorious incident back in 1919, the Amritsar massacre, where a protest meeting had taken place in Amritsar, and the British Army simply went in there, and the officer commanding had been educated at Middleton College, and the Governor General of the area was a Tipperary Catholic, Michael Dwyer, and the General ordered his troops to open fire, and at the bare minimum, the British accepted 350 were killed. The Indians say that approximately 1,000 were killed in a few minutes. Simple, just absolute, outright massacre.
And the order was from General Dwyer to Tipperary.
Governor General Dwyer was he was the civilian governor. General Dwyer, which
just,
is
just to confuse me.
Exactly.
Okay. No, just interesting to know because
and the headline. I think it was the Freeman's Journal, maybe the Independent. The following morning after Croke Park was Ireland's Amritsar. Mm. The sense that this is what the British Army did when their imperial interests were threatened.
That's crazy. Really, really crazy. And you wonder how they excused it afterwards or attempted to.
Well, they came up with the classic excuse, we were fired upon first. And
they did also arrest two senior IRA figures, one of whom was part of Collins' squad, and assassinated them that night.
They had been arrested. They picked them up earlier.
Oh.
And another civilian who had nothing to do with it. Mm.
Wrong place, wrong time.
In rather a fanciful excuse that they were shot while trying to escape. It just so happened that the British tried to stage the event with a photographer there and reproduce this image in some of the newspapers as proof that this individual had tried to escape.
Well, so there's some strange things that the British attempt to do to explain events, as we'll get to in the burning.
Yeah, I mean the old
geographically moving buildings.
Exactly. I mean the old story about truth being the first casualty of war.
Do we think that, it must have been a field day for the media. I'd say everybody everywhere was just like, what's going to be next?
Well, that was it. I mean, that was the question. I mean, now, as it turns out, that's the worst day in terms of total casualties. Mm.
And that's a Sunday, 20th of November.
Yeah.
So is it the 28th of November then? It's the first time we've mentioned him. Tom Barry, well, maybe not actually, but first time we'll talk about him in a wider way. Tom Barry,
yes,
in West Cork, is it number IRA number three?
Yeah. I mean the number three brigade. I mean Tom Barry himself was an interesting figure, a former member of the British Army who'd served in now Iraq, Mesopotamia. He was the son of an RAC man, born in Kerry, but had come back from Roscarbery. In fact, if you go down to Roscarbery, there's a little memorial there to O'Donovan Rosser, who's a local, Michael Collins, as it were, who's a local, and Tom Barry. So certainly a decided focal point there. So Tom Barry had to, in effect, prove himself to the local eye. He offers his services, but there was a fear that he could be a plant.
And was there some sense that it was his disgruntlement post-World War One at how British soldiers were looked after? And
it's impossible to be absolutely certain because of that he, in terms of his rationalisation and explanation as to why he joins, is written afterwards. And of course, that's affected by everything that had happened in between. So it's impossible to be absolutely certain. Certainly, there seems to be a disgruntlement that the British saying thank you for all your service, now go by. And all the troops, whether they were from recruited in Ireland or in England, that there was a sense that the government wasn't doing right by them.
Not the only soldiers in the world to ever say that. That's how they get treated often.
Well, it is. And the problem was that the sheer numbers of troops involved, I mean, they're huge conscript armies, and the government simply couldn't really look after them in the way that they'd promised.
I suppose what I wanted to ask was, you know, does Bloody Sunday create Kilmichael, or was it happening anyway?
No. I mean, that was going to happen anyway.
There was a force in Macroom who were harassing.
Yes.
They were harassing local villages, Castletown Kenny, and
had already shot dead at least one civilian, and were doing what in effect they were sent to Ireland to do, which was to make life hell for rebels. As far as the auxiliaries were concerned, I suppose, and this is true to a certain extent for the army, the RAC Black and Tans, also Special Constabulary and the like, that it was impossible to distinguished between an IRA member and a civilian because the IRA didn't wear uniforms. And as a consequence, there was a tendency to regard every single civilian as a potential IRA member, certainly every male. And of course, there was also the women were known to be carrying messages and operating safe houses as well. So from that point of view, it's no great surprise that wherever the auxiliaries were stationed, they tended to rough up the locality to try and make, as it were, the problems of supporting the IRA worse than supporting the government. It was a curious way to go around winning the hearts and minds of a civilian population by burning down houses or carrying out raids, imprisoning or interning large numbers of people. But as far as the auxiliaries were concerned, it seemed to be working. And what Barry wished to do was to send out a clear message to both the local auxiliary companies, to the British Crown Forces generally, and I suppose to also the Republican side, is that it wasn't going to be tolerated and that you could take them on. I mean, there was a sense that a fear that the auxiliaries were untouchable, precisely because they were mobile. I mean, this is the crucial thing about the auxiliaries. Unlike the Black and Tans or the Royal Irish Constabulary, and even just unlike the army, which didn't have that much transport, the auxiliary division is small, but it has pretty much complete transport. It has armoured cars, it has lorries and the like, so it can move wherever it believes it needs to go very, very quickly. And its job is to hunt and destroy the IRA. And Barry believed that there was a sense of fear within the IRA that these men were untouchable and they were the best that the British could provide. So Barry took it as a challenge to demonstrate that you didn't have to fear them. And that if you went after them, they were in certain respects even more vulnerable than the RAC or the army, precisely because the RAC or army were operating largely from barracks, whereas the auxiliaries tried to billet themselves in houses or, for example, in Macroom Castle, a non-fortified position. So from that point of view, it was almost the gauntlet had been thrown down by the auxiliary division.
And do you think this is the most significant operation in the War of Independence?
Well, in military terms,
because the British at this point had were denying that there was a war.
Of course,
and this was the moment where they could no longer deny it anymore. I've been down to the site, and I'd recommend anyone interested to visit Kilmichael. They've laid it out incredibly well with information stands at different points, and it's just remarkable to think. So they'd noted the movements stupidly by the auxiliaries. They were taking the same route back on regular manoeuvres.
Yeah. Well, and this was as well as part of the conceit and arrogance of the auxiliaries. They genuinely believed that they were untouchable and they didn't have to take the normal precautions that certainly the RAC, the regular RAC, and even the military were taking at this point. But the British had persisted with this interpretation that they spun to their own population and internationally, that what was going on was armed criminality, and that it was a criminal conspiracy. There was no popular support, that these weren't soldiers. These were, in effect, an Irish version of the mafia. And when the reports come through of what had happened at Kilmichael, where you have an entire unit of 18 or so officers, all veterans, all experienced from the First World War, all willing to use and able to use their weapons, had been, in effect, wiped out. It brings home to the British, and if one has a look at the specific cabinet discussion that takes place on the following morning, there is a reference that this is more akin to regular warfare than anything that had happened before.
They didn't think the IRA had that capability.
No, they didn't.
Has Lloyd George already said that they have murder by the throat?
I think that comes. I'd have to just check exactly that particular phrase.
You'd be surprised if he managed to say that after an event like
that. Well,
like
no, because what the British then do is that they start upping particularly their intelligence game in the rest of Ireland. And this is when you start having the really disturbed period in terms of execution of civilians by the IRA, particularly in December, January, February, January, February 1922, because the British do start to achieve a number of successes over the IRA in terms of the Mourne Abbey ambush and a number of others also.
In the early parts of 1921. Yeah. For those, though, that don't know, so Tom Barry assembles his number 3 Brigade in West Cork.
Well, the Flying Column of the number 3 Brigade, the number 3 Brigade. McCurtain and McSweeney had been in charge of the number 1 Brigade, which was basically the city and sort of East Cork, as it were. Number 2 Brigade is more North Cork, and then the Cork number 3 Brigade is West Cork.
And are they all flying columns? Is that a...
No, it's sort of they handpick the best men from all the various different companies. And the flying column then is in effect a full-time...
Out in the hills, you're out in the... staying where you can stay and the like.
So they had been assembled for about a week beforehand. So Barry wanted to put them through their paces and to make sure that when this ambush took place.
Everyone did what
they were told. But again, it's important to remember that this would be the first time that any of the members had gone through that sustained military training over a number of days. Practically all of them up to that point, they might have undertaken some drilling or some basic military maneuvers, but none of them had been on a week-long training camp.
But they'd have been involved in some operations. But
they would.
It's still a significant.
But this is a much bigger thing. That you're not taking on a small patrol of the RIC, for example.
They take up three positions.
Yeah.
Two on the right hand side of the road, looking north, and one on the left. Two tenders. Is that what they're called?
Crossley tenders. Yeah.
With maybe 18 soldiers.
I think nine in each.
Coming down the road. Weirdly or bizarrely, a number of IRA men arrive on the scene just before the Crossley. So Barry has his three positions taken, and while they're waiting on the tenders to come, and they're there for the whole day.
Yes.
I think they're in position from 8 a.m. and it's something like 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
And they had marched to that position overnight in the pouring rain as well. So these were tough men.
So other IRA men arrive on the scene by chance just before the tenders come. So they manage to scoot them up a kind of a side road and it doesn't blow the game. Barry stands on a low wall at the end in IRA uniform, or, with the trench coat, with the stylings of an IRA man, causes the first Crossley tender to stop. The other one's further back up the road, closer to one of the other positions. And...
You then just had a firefight breaks out.
But he throws a bomb in the window, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he's pretty close. The film The Wind That Shakes the Barley, even though technically that's
not
a fictional account, but in terms of the depiction of the engagement, that's modelled clearly on Kilmichael.
Yeah.
So the first lorry is engaged, and precisely the position where that was stopped, which is Barry ensured that it stopped. At that point, it was in effect in a crossfire, and those who were engaged are killed pretty quickly. The second lorry was a little bit further back. It was one elementary precaution that the British had learned was to keep your lorries spread out so they wouldn't necessarily all be targeted at once. So the IRA who'd taken out the first lorry, they'd start to manoeuvre around so they can start bringing their fire to bear on the second lorry.
And the third position is attacking that other tender at the time.
And of course, you then have the controversy...
over the fake surrenders.
Yeah. When I say controversy, I mean, I frankly, I'm not inclined to view it as a controversy. I frankly don't doubt that there was a false surrender. There's some suggestion that because Barry, in his immediate response, doesn't make reference to this, that somehow implies that he had devised this subsequently. But depending on your point of view, I mean, if you believe that a full surrender took place, that the British call out, the IRA reveal themselves, the British shoot some of those involved, and then Barry says, that's it, okay, no more
shoot surrenders. Shoot until I say stop.
Yeah, and according to this account, the British did try to surrender again, and no surrender was accepted. Or if you accept... if you reject that and you take the line that was taken by the British subsequently, which is that the surrender had taken place and prisoners were executed. I say, from my point of view, I mean, and again, remember that when you're shouting out, we surrender, from one position, gunfire going on, it isn't necessarily going to be heard by everybody on all sides.
But the fact seems to be that two IRA men reveal their position after the surrender and they're shot by the men who had surrendered, and that's when Barry says...
Yeah.
One man escaped who was later captured that day and killed. Did one man survive?
He did, but he was very badly... I think brain damage for the rest of his life.
I mean, as glorious an event as it is in the foundation of the state, and again, it's a horrific
scene.
Well,
it is. I mean,
are real people with brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers. And
coming back to that point about the impact upon those who won the engagement. Mm. I mean, Barry makes a point then of lining them up in the road. And of course, it's getting dark now. This is November. The bodies are lying around. You have the trucks are burning, and he drills the men up and down.
Goodness.
Some of them are crying because of the shock of what had taken
place. And they've lost friends.
Of course. And it was as a baptism of fire in terms of that type of full-on military engagement. I mean, it was horrendous. And again, one shouldn't underestimate the extent to which, at a psychological level, obviously at a physical level, those who are killed are dead, but those who survive are, how much they might have been celebrated subsequently and feted in song as the boys of Kilmichael. I mean, to kill a man, even for trained soldiers, highly trained soldiers, is not necessarily an easy business. For untrained soldiers who haven't been given the months of training and conditioning that you could do in a regular army, then of course it is going to be difficult.
There were some injuries and men had to be spirited away to receive treatment and bodies had to be stashed so that they could be buried. And then, of course, the auxiliaries lose the plot in the general area and, you know, well, all of Kilmichael, I think, is razed to the ground almost. Well, it's a small rural area, but any of the buildings are burned.
Yes. And again, on the basis that what had happened elsewhere in the country when a much smaller instance had taken place, then it was absolutely certain that there was going to be heavy reprisals. And of course, you also have reprisals not just in Kilmichael, but the troops in Cork. You have smaller...
Well, this adds all into it, doesn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I mean, there's the sense of the situation is just spiralling out of control in the same week as you have... And you also have, remember, the execution of one of the members of the British Army who'd mutinied in India. And he's executed this week, and also the body of Father Griffin, the priest in Galway who'd been kidnapped a few days before. His body is uncovered, and it's clear that he'd been executed by the auxiliaries. So you have a sense that in this one week, everything seems to be happening. And certainly when...
And is it the Sunday after Bloody Sunday? I think it's the 28th of November.
Yeah, well, it's maybe 8 days
I'm just trying to, it's a Monday. Yeah. Exactly. For me, that gives it some kind of a context in a way. It's a Monday, you know?
But I suppose in a rural area, sort of in November, I suppose there isn't a huge amount of farm work going on and the like. But I mean, it certainly was just a truly awful week, and every single day that brings news.
14 days later, or 11 to 12 days later, is what we're sort of building to in this bit is that incredible incident of the city being burnt. So the auxiliaries are bent on revenge.
Absolutely, I mean, there's no question about this. I mean, the auxiliaries are out for blood. They didn't necessarily concern themselves whose blood, because as far as they were concerned, in Kilmichael, the reason that they put forward for burning all the houses in the locality is that it couldn't have happened if those in the locality had not been sympathetic. Now, of course, that was pretty tough on those in the locality because...
What were they going to do against...
Well, I mean...
were they going to tell the IRA no?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, of course, you mentioned there about the fact that you do have IRA men turning up unannounced, as it were, and uninvited, which was a signal that the word had gone out. There was a knowledge that
that makes more sense.
But that's a dangerous thing. I mean,
if it got out to them,
exactly that you could have had reinforcements, it could have been a trap. So that was something that Barry was concerned about, the release of that information.
I picked up a copy of The Burning of Cork, the book in St. Peter's, who have a wonderful... As soon as we're able to get back in, I'd recommend people check out the Cork 2020 exhibition.
It's superb.
St. Peter's on North Main Street. Do you know who wrote the book, The Burning of Cork?
Michael Lennon.
God, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But in it, one of the things that I picked up was that obviously there'd been previous attempts to burn City Hall and all sorts of arson activity during the hours of curfew by whoever, by the Black and Tans, by the auxiliaries, by the RIC,
the military.
By the military. But what I had read in it is that for a period of the year or at times, the military firefighting services had assisted.
Yes.
At different things that didn't. So, look, to lead into the burning of Cork, it's Dillon's Cross and the Delaneys. Yep. That's an audacious... Because seemingly Dillon's Cross, because of its proximity to Victoria Barracks, was a an area relatively untouched by trouble. Not on the night of the 11th, the 11th.
It's an audacious ambush. It takes place, I think, approximately 100 yards from... the gates of the barracks. I mean, those in the barracks would have heard what was going on. They didn't rush to their assistance, primarily because they feared that if they did, that you could get another ambush.
So this is an IRA attack. There's a hard right turn that requires vehicles to slow, and there's a fake wall, and behind it are 6, 7, eight city IRA men,
and those who are in the vehicles are sitting ducks, as you say. You can't manoeuvre, you can't reverse, you can't go forward. You have to slow
down.
Is it
a bomb? Is it a?
I'd have to check.
I think it's an incendiary device of some kind.
Incendiary device.
And presumably some shooting.
And weapons, exactly, yes. And again, it's fire and move. I mean, they didn't hang around. But you didn't have to hang around because the troops are packed in close together. And this is one of the differences between operating in an urban environment and operating in Michael.
It sounds like one of the most significant encounters in the city. I mean, that sort
of stuff. To that point, yes. I mean, again, precisely because it's so close to the barracks. It is like the one
By the way, just to add in here, it just occurred to me, because obviously McSweeney is buried on the 1st of November after his death on hunger strike, but there were others who died of hunger strike. They're presumably... that's still occurring, and there's funerals.
No, the hunger strike itself had been called off. I think it's about the 11th or 12th.
Okay. Of November.
Of November. There had been a debate about that had taken place since McSweeney's funeral as to whether there was any point in continuing the full value, as it were, had been extracted as a result of the three men who died up to that point. But of course, it was for those who were on the strike. They had insisted they were going to continue. They had refused a request. It certainly wasn't an order coming from Bishop Corlin 2-3 days before. And it was Arthur Griffith, who was then the acting president of the Dáil, who directed that they should come off the strike.
Okay, so the context anyway is just extraordinary. The whole, it's just hard to believe that this is all in a matter of days, weeks, and months.
And again, remember that there's a constant backdrop of lots of things happening. Again, small scale, but sniping, small scale operations.
So the IRA ambush, Dillon's Cross, the auxiliaries aren't backed up immediately for fear of further ambush. One dies, nine injured type thing.
Yeah. Which, given that it was a pretty short engagement, was a very, very high casualty rate.
Yeah. The hounds seemingly were used by the military to hunt people down.
Yes.
They go to a known IRA sympathiser.
Well,
members
of the 1st Battalion of the 1st Cork Brigade, the Delaney brothers, it's their family home. Two of those who were involved in the ambush had gone to the house, which wasn't a huge distance away. But as you say, the British... apparently, one of those involved had dropped a cap. The British were able to get their bloodhounds, track them to the house. The father of the house is knocked up in the middle of the night. He isn't touched, as it were, but those involved simply storm into the house. Not dissimilar, of course, to the manner in which Tomás McCurtain met his end. And two brothers are then shot. And another member of the household, the uncle, their uncle was also shot. The Delaney brothers, of course, GA Club is named in their honour.
So that is Saturday, 11th of December. This is the beginning of the burning of Cork. Yeah. It's an operation that is believed to have been planned irrespective of this ambush. That just probably adds...
Again, this is a point to...
lights the litmus.
Yeah, I mean, really important point to remember is that there had been... a policy of reprisal. Every single time there had been a serious incident for many weeks, if not months, there had been a response. Certainly that the scale of the operation, and this is, again, some overtones of the Tomás McCurtain assassination. It was practically impossible to conceive that you could, in hot blood, get all, for example, the equipment that you would need to carry out this operation at short notice. So I don't think there's any doubt that it was pre-planned, which is, of course, one of the things that had perhaps led the IRA, the city brigade, the city battalion of the IRA, to hold their hand temporarily. But without any question, the auxiliaries are the ones who carry it out and the ones who have a distinct plan. I mean, they make a point of targeting certain buildings. It's very interesting. I mean, this gives an indication of just perhaps saying how so the caliber of some of those involved. They make a point of trying to build from a burn from a commercial point of view some of the most valuable premises. On the one hand, putting a large number of people unemployed, but of course you're then going to alienate the very business class that historically had been probably considered to be the backbone of sympathy for the union. The very people who in theory, whose sympathies you were in probably should have been courting, the ones who you're alienating.
The way you're speaking there is making me think, though. I mean, it feels like relatively wild abandon that causes this. Like, is there a black and tan guy sitting in an office planning this?
Well, Colonel Latimer was the controller. He's ultimately demoted.
Just to say, Dillon's Cross, so the people are forced into their houses earlier than curfew, burning commences.
Yeah. I mean, the curfew begins at 10, but from about 9 o'clock onwards, which of course, I mean, remember at that point, it's pitch black.
It's
pitch black. And there are reports that the soldiers were just shooting randomly without any sort of warning being given.
They're also raiding stores and whiskey, and they're all getting tanked up a bit. But have they started pouring into town at this point?
They just come down the hill and they start. The other auxiliaries that are inside in the barracks and some regular soldiers. Although it's interesting, some of the stories that some regular soldiers are sympathetic to the auxiliaries, but there generally there seems to be at least an attempt made by some regular army officers to prevent what's happening. There's one officer who gives his men an armoured car under his control, orders to shoot the auxiliaries if they continue to behave in this riotous way. Although, interestingly, he said, "I didn't give my orders to my own enlisted men to shoot privates and corporals, simply because you could have had a gun battle between the auxiliaries and the British Army." And who knows how that could have turned out.
It's chaos.
And so there's reports breaking out of fires occurring all over the place. I mean, this clearly can't be an accident. I mean, if there had been one building that a fire had caught, then it might be explained accidentally. But a number of fires were breaking out at dislocated points all over the city centre, including, of course, City Hall. Despite the fact that at least some of the British sought to move City Hall and a map in around Patrick Street to suggest that somehow it had caught fire accidentally or as a result of fire spreading from elsewhere. But there's extensive amounts of petrol being used. Again, given the fact that this is all happening in curfew, there is no suggestion that any civilian could possibly be involved.
And it's right the way through the night.
It is.
Like City Hall is seemingly one of the later places targeted, and Carnegie Free Library with it as well. Yeah. And presumably the fire, they'd stationed some of the fire service by City Hall because of how frequently it was being targeted, but presumably they had long gone to some other area of the city.
You couldn't fight all the fires.
Winthrop Street, Mailer Street, it's that south side of Patrick Street.
And it's a block, basically. I mean, it's more than a block because Roach's Store goes and caches, and it's sheer absolute destruction. Some of the pictures that you
and
see,
remember, the workers are living above these
and the owners of some of the premises. And it isn't just the bigger stores, even though they seem to be peculiarly targeted. But if you had a small little, like a seamstress shop or something like that, then you would live above the shop. So you have hundreds of people lose their homes, as well as thousands of people losing their jobs.
Jewelers are massively targeted for looting.
The looting was systematic. I mean, and there seems to be, again, preordained, because the shops where you would have high value and low weight, such as jewelers, are the ones that are particularly targeted, along with pubs. And certainly there were very few pubs that survived with their stock intact after the end of the night.
Fire service members have their hoses bayoneted or punctured. Some of them are fired upon and injured.
And again, you mentioned there that there is no turnout of the military fire appliances, which had been the case in some of the fires earlier on in the year, which again give an indication that within the barracks, within the former military unit stationed there, there was a division of opinion. Some of them were determined to try and follow their orders and keep some sort of order and prevent the auxiliaries simply wrecking havoc, while other members of the military were sympathetic to what had gone on. Again, remember that there is a memory of of Bloody Sunday and the bitterness that's being felt and of Kilmichael, and the bitterness that's felt is very, very...
And it's K Company, I think, is worth mentioning, isn't it? Because they're disbanded within 6 months. They're all shipped down to Dunmanway after it, or a load of them.
Well, they had killed, remember, Canon Magner and another civilian who was with them before then. So they were arguably the most notorious unit within the whole auxiliary division, and the auxiliary division as a whole was noted for its indiscipline. So they were even more so than
the Black and Tans.
Yes, much more than so. Black and Tans, precisely because again,
because the auxiliaries were arguably sort of, the Black and Tans were a mixture of sort of deconscripted soldiers and people looking for a gig, give us a job. But the Oxys were ex. So they should have had
very highly paid a pound a day, all the equipment that they could wish for in terms of modern weaponry, in terms of motorized vehicles and the like, and they were the absolute cutting edge. So again, the combination between the Kilmichael ambush, where a unit had been wiped out, and what had happened in Dunmanway, and then the burning of Cork, brings public attention onto the auxiliary division in a way that the British government simply didn't like. It's also, of course, remembering that the British carried out their own military inquiry. General Strickland, who is the general officer commanding the forces in Munster, stationed in Victoria Barracks, he carries out an inquiry. And again, if these minutes are freely available, when the British cabinet consider his report, he said there's no question about it. These are the auxiliaries. It's an open and shut case. General Tudor, who was the head of the auxiliary, auxiliary units. He was technically in charge of all the police. He is outraged that, in effect, the army is shaming its own. He commissions...
But it's not publicly released, though.
No,
it's not.
And Tudor commissions his own report, which, of course, exculpates those involved. But in the cabinet discussion, there is a clear statement that if this is released, it will have a devastating impact upon our position. So we just don't release it.
And who is Strickland, the guy in Cork, who's responsible? Who's the head honcho?
Strickland wouldn't have been in charge of the auxiliaries precisely because they were nominally attached to the police, the RAC. So General Tudor was the overall commissar, as it were, of all the police forces, and that includes the Ulster Special Constabulary, includes the regular RIC, Black and Tans and auxiliaries. The commander of the auxiliary division was a fellow called General Crozer, again a senior military figure. He did try to impose some discipline on the auxiliary division, precisely because he realised that its activities were being absolutely counterproductive. You were driving people into the arms of the IRA, and you were punishing many unionists in terms of their indiscriminate actions. When he does try to dismiss a number of members of the auxiliary division who were particularly ill-disciplined, General Tudor then reinstates them, and General Crozier then simply resigns. To say that if this is what the British government wants the auxiliary division to be absolutely above and beyond the law, then he said that he wouldn't have any part of it. So K Company were the worst, but they were by no means exceptional.
In a general sense, because within the auxiliary division, or on the night in Cork.
Well, no, within the auxiliary division, they were probably the most notorious unit. But they were, as it were, it's part of a spectrum, and they're at one end of the spectrum. But most of the other units were close enough.
On the night of the 11th into the 12th.
Absolutely. But nobody is, I mean, there's the small inquiries. I think there's a couple of...
Well, they were held in camera, weren't they?
Yes, exactly.
Apparently there was a lawyer applied to, and they were lawyers.
Yes, no lawyers.
There was all sorts of
things.
And
it's held in Victoria Barracks itself, of course, from which those who participated in the attack had emanated.
But yet, even taking all those things into account, still the end report...
In effect, fingers
softly, but still points the finger.
But there is no real disciplinary action. I mean,
and there's no compensation until a much later date. In fact, I think seemingly the city is charged for
the city is, and that had been one of the ways in which the British had sought to try and punish the civilian population for what they saw as their complicity in the crimes. That this was true not just in Cork on that night, but more generally, that where property had been destroyed. A levy was placed on all the ratepayers. And this was going to be imposed as a charge on all the ratepayers in the county. So from that point of view, yes, I mean, and again, there was an idea of collective punishment, that you would hurt any sympathisers, civilian sympathisers with the IRA. But again, all that simply served to do was to drive more people into the ranks of the IRA on the basis that if they're going to penalise us anyway, whether we support the IRA or not, we might as well support the IRA and get them out.
What a shocking, horrifying and just incredible incident to happen in the lifetime of the city on and over that night. We mentioned it that within day or seemingly very quickly, some of the media reports across the water in the UK, there was a map drawn up that placed City Hall into the centre of the city,
What it sought to do was to suggest they had burnt themselves
yes. and it had caught the rest of the place on fire.
And they seem to suggest that there was a building called City Hall, which wasn't part of the municipal buildings. The map shows the municipal buildings,
but somehow
City Hall had lifted itself up and transposed itself 200 yards or 300 yards.
It's kind of, it probably just shows the chaos and the craziness of the time that they sort of got away with that. That was just
just
another incident.
Much the same way, I suppose, again, coming back to Morse McCurtain, on the basis that things are happening in the dark. When
hard to tell what really happened.
Exactly. And their faces are covered.
Oh, of course they'd say that. Propaganda. Yeah,
exactly.
And don't believe a word of it. And
exactly.
No.
Exactly.
Meantime, in the background of this, because I kind of want to wrap up 1920, what a year. There's a priest somewhere who is beginning tentative connections. So there's a, for want of a better term, actually I think the term was used at the time, peace process.
Yes, peace feelers being sent out.
Which doesn't work at that time. Yeah. And seemingly the last 6 months of the war in independence, either the same amount of people die again as had already died.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, you know, it's just...
Well, the second half, the months of 1921, you have a number of really awful events. The IRA start losing serious numbers of men that they couldn't afford to lose. I mean, from the British point of view, they always had fresh recruits that they could bring into Ireland. So if they lost 18...
Well, they had 30,000 military
exactly.
in the country.
So
Custom House in Dublin being one of them.
Exactly. So it was a far more serious matter for the IRA to lose 10 men than it was for the British.
There's one I hadn't heard of before until relatively recently. A farmhouse, I think it's somewhere in East Cork, where there was a bunch. Is
Clonmult?
That's the one.
Because
I don't know where Clonmult is.
Yeah, it's just beyond Middleton.
Okay.
And that's the IRA's worst defeat. Mm. In fact, that's the name of one of the books on this thing. But
there and anyway, that's early 1921.
Yeah, early 1921. But I mean, the problem is that the IRA now believe that intelligence is being passed to the British, because there's no way that the British would be able to, in effect, pick off their ambushes so freely. And you then start to have to search for people who are passing on intelligence to the British. And this is where the very serious number incidents of shooting of informers starts taking place.
And just to give people context, that it's 1935 before City Hall is rebuilt.
Yeah.
It's kind of 1924 before many of the buildings around Patrick Street are rebuilt. It's a slow process. There is some compensation. The claims that people put in, they get about half of that towards it. William Roach is one man who was woken up in the morning to be told that he gets a tram in deathly silence all around the place, stopped by what he perceives to be slightly inebriated soldiers en route. Where are you off to? I'm William Roach and I've heard my story. And he's sent on in. And amazingly, you know, it just shows the tenacity of people generally. By the way, one of his claims, and we see it in there's some footage from the early 1900s of Cork City Centre and a big Union Jack flying over Roach's stores.
He
puts in a claim for that. And he's treated more leniently because there's a sense that if he's flying a Union Jack, he might have Unionist sympathies.
There is one important aftermath of the of the burning, which I think should be mentioned, which is the excommunication order, which is issued by Bishop Cole in the immediate aftermath.
A solo run.
I mean, there hadn't been, for example, anything similar issued by Archbishop Walsh of Dublin in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday. There are a number of reasons. Bishop Colin himself.
So it's an excommunication. He says anybody involved in these incidents from here on.
Anybody who's involved
I'll excommunicate
in ambushing or arson. Now, technically, it applies to both the British and Irish side. And of course, remember that there were Catholics serving in the British forces as well. But clearly, it's interpreted by the IRA as being directed towards them. They were outraged because, as far as they were concerned, there hadn't been a word of condemnation specifically against the British for what they had done. So it was seen to be, and of course, it was peculiarly directed towards them. I would put in perhaps a little word of mitigation. And it comes back to the fact that what happened in the burning of Cork and what had happened before and what had happened subsequently was policy on the part of the British. It was a policy on the part of the British to carry out reprisals. It is only officially sanctioned in January 1921, where the British announced we're going to have this policy. But it had been the policy for many, many months. Tralee had been burned, Balbriggan had been burned, Knockrockery was going to be burned. There had been any number of instances where the British had simply carried out reprisals with absolute impunity. So as far as Corlin was concerned, it wasn't that the British were out of control. It's that the British were in control. And they were doing this as coal-headed policy. As were, if it had been done in hot blood, it would, you perhaps would not necessarily expect it to happen on every occasion. But the fact that it is happening on every occasion shows that the British are doing this deliberately and they're going to target civilians. So Corlin took the perspective that as a bishop, he had to take the bigger picture, as it were. And that if civilians were going to be caught up in the aftermath of engagements, as of course had happened in the aftermath of Dillon's Cross ambush, that he had to take a stand. But it was something for which he wasn't forgiven by the IRA. The IRA simply bypassed him and went to Father Dominic of the Capuchin Fathers, who wrote a letter basically saying he doesn't know what he's talking about. This is wrong theologically. You are doing this as soldiers. This is your job. And a soldier has no more need to confess for acting as a soldier than anybody else was in confession, which was a very, very brave thing to do for a junior cleric to simply tell Catholics, conscientious, diligent Catholics, ignore the bishop in this occasion. It was something which struck, as it were, the very heart of the nature of Catholic, the Catholic hierarchy. But so it starts to reveal some of the problems within the church there as well. The fact that the church itself is now increasingly coming under attack. There is a priest that is killed attached to the cathedral in the early months of 1921. Of course, it tends to lend a sense of urgency to the church's own deliberations. But certainly Bishop Corlin is well in advance of any other bishop, including many bishops who were much less sympathetic to advanced nationalism than him. And this is one of the ironies, that Corlin was considered to be one of the most advanced nationalists within the hierarchy, albeit not a member of Sinn Féin and not necessarily an advocate of physical force republicanism. But it's simply because everything is happening on his watch. It's his diocese where these things are happening. And he believes it's necessary to take a stand, as it were, to defend the civilian population against what he knows will be the inevitable and coal-headed official government-sanctioned onslaughts that will certainly occur in the aftermath of any of these operations.
And we thought we've had a bad year.
No,
in 2020. Yes. We're all sort of eager for the new year in the hope that this next year will be better as they were 100 years ago.
Yes.
Is that next year better?
Not initially. I mean, the first 6 months you mentioned there earlier on, that the first 6 months of 1921 are just awful in terms of...
But I guess ultimately we get peace and a treaty.
The truce is agreed in the summer of 1921, but you also have, for example...
But then the Civil War kicks off immediately.
Yeah. Well, again, also remember, not so much from a Cork point of view, but in December of 1920, you had the passage of the Government of Ireland Act, which introduces the border. That border starts...
Sorry, what I wanted to get... When did martial law get? Was that after Bloody
Martial
Sunday?
Martial law is in November 19... maybe December. It's either November...
It's after Bloody Sunday.
It's no, in Cork. It's imposed in Cork, first of all. It's in the aftermath of Kilmichael. Now, whether it's a day or...
So now the law is out of the hands of the politicians.
Yes, and it's in the hands of the general. So while you could still be tried by an ordinary court if you're...
Is possibly why the inquest now is a sealed military one.
Well, this has already been decided. This has been the practice for some months at this point, really since the passage of the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act, some months before, which had been the act which allowed the British to start executing the prisoners, provided them in their own eyes with the legal basis for the execution of people like Kevin Barry. But you then have the imposition of martial law, you have the passage of the Government of Ireland Act creating the border, which of course remains most certainly with
and that
us.
Was a unionist demand.
It's interesting that again, this would probably take at least another hour to go through this discussion. The initial recommendation from the committee that was appointed to devise recommendations for Irish self-government was that it should be a 9-county border, that there should be partition, but you should both have a 9-county border and what we would nowadays call powerful cross-border bodies, a Council of Ireland. What the British wanted, the Conservative Party wanted a united Ireland, but under British rule. Mm. They didn't want Ireland to become a dominion, which is ultimately what happens. But they were prepared to, at this point, concede home rule to the whole of Ireland. What they didn't want is exactly what happens, which is that Ireland is partitioned and then the South goes its own way completely, cuts its ties with Westminster, primarily because that meant the Southern Unionist constituency, of which there are a large number of Southern Unionists in Cork, in places like Bandon and the city centre. And of course, that population, coming back to the events of the first 6 months of 1921, that population is one of the population that, in their eyes, seems to be targeted in the IRA's search for informants for the British in that first 6 months.
And that is a controversial topic,
isn't it? It most certainly is. It most certainly is. But again, it's something
as to
that,
whether it was a deliberate policy and even whether there was a religious aspect whereby Protestants were being targeted. As
for their religious faith as opposed to their actions. That, again, that's a huge debate which I've no doubt will probably be coming back to at some point in time.
So how do we wrap up then 1920 in that sense? So some of what I'd read in that Burning of Cork book was that some of that K Company were sent, they were sent out of the city.
Yeah.
You referenced the cannon that was shot. That was in Dunmanway,
yes.
Was it? Because
yep.
I'd read that some of that K Company were sent down to Dunmanway and other things happened. And then they slowly, by April, I think, of the next year, they were gone.
Well, and many of them... Many of them simply resign. And again, not just in K Company, but generally many auxiliaries realise in the aftermath of Kilmichael that they're not going to have it their own way. And the IRA are going after them. So from that point, some of them resign. So a small number are dismissed, although, as we've already mentioned earlier on, some of them are reinstated after being dismissed. And some of them are posted to parts of the country which aren't as literally as hot as it is in Cork. When one has a look at some of the newspaper editorials on New Year's Eve and on New Year's Day in 1920-21, there certainly is the sense that, thank God, that has gone. But at that point, precisely as you mentioned, that the initial peace feelers had been repudiated by the British, largely because they felt that the IRA was weakening and that the British needed to keep up this policy of coercion in order to absolutely crush things. But there is this uncertainty as to what the next year will bring. As you say, what it does bring ultimately is peace of a sort, at least temporarily, from the truce in the summer of 1921. But of course, war breaks out again in the South in the summer of 1922. And of course, remember, in the first 6 months of 1922, you also had absolute carnage in the north. The first 6 months of 1922 are worse even than 1972 in terms of the absolute scale of bloodshed and destruction.
And that's largely led by the unionist side.
Well, it's interesting that it's also partly because the IRA, which at that point was on the verge of splitting into the pro and anti treaty factions, and to a certain extent already had, Michael Collins, who of course was negotiating with James Craig, the new Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, as he of course was negotiating with the British because he was head of the provisional government, believed the one way that you could keep IRA unity was to focus your attention on the one thing that the common enemy, which is the unionist regime in the north. What it also does, of course, is to get the anti-treaty IRA out of the south while Collins is building up the National Army, which, of course, he's going to put into the field in the Civil War.
So there is a period of about a year between treaty and...
And the Civil War in the south.
An interesting sort of... The eye of the storm.
Yeah, yeah. There's that 6 months, but, of course, that itself...
6 months, is that
yeah,
all?
Yeah, roughly speaking, the summer of...
Because, when you look back at... what a 15-year period.
Yes, absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
Like the new country, when it finally began to get on its legs in 1924, yeah. Full of bitterness, full of destruction, poor...
Yeah,
like just what a way to begin.
I mean, if you'd been a betting man or woman in 1911, you're saying in the next 10 years we're almost going to come to a civil war over home rule. We're going to have a severe crisis over female suffrage. We're going to have one of Europe's great industrial conflicts in the 1913 lockout. We're going to go through a massive European war, the First World War. We're going to have the rise of physical force republic, and we're going to have the centre of Dublin levelled in a rising. We're going to have a full-scale war of independence. We're going to have tens of thousands of troops deployed. You're going to have Cork burned down. You're going to have Trim, Balbriggan and other places burned down. You're going to have hundreds of people killed. You're going to have the country partitioned. And at the end of it, the one part of the country which was absolutely opposed to home rule, which is the north, is the one part that gets it. And you're going to have the south of the island becoming a self-governing dominion. If you'd said to somebody to that in 1911, they would not have believed you. But that is the story of what happens in Ireland over that 10 years.
And we live in that country, yes, today, and yep. The six counties remain in. Yep, like yep. It's a living history. It is.
Well, I mean, and of course, the border is still a very live political issue because mm-hmm. of Brexit, which yeah. is coming up. Yeah. The aforementioned New Year's Eve in 1920, that there's going to be a very interesting
development
on New Year's Day in 2021 because of Brexit.
True. And could it be that ultimately English nationalism brings about the unification of Ireland?
Yes, exactly.
And on that note, we leave again with UCC. Thank you very much.
This is
the conclusion of episode 3 of the Cork History Matters podcast, where we were looking at the events of 1920. And boy, were they some events.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.